Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll be joined by Michael Gonzalez, a forensic science master's student at California State University in Fresno. We'll talk about the computerized mammal hair database that he's developed and how it can be used by wildlife forensic scientists to identify hair in cases of illegal trafficking of the world's most endangered animals. But first, let me play you today's creature call. This week's creature call is the sound of a flying mammal that ranges from Canada to northern South America and the Caribbean islands. You can find them in trees and attics where they consume extremely high numbers of insects. Now listen carefully and see if you can guess this flying mammal. At the end of the show, I'll play these sounds again and tell you what kind of animal made them. Now, let me turn to my conversation on wildlife forensics and mammal hair with Michael Gonzalez. Michael Gonzalez is a forensic science master's student at California State University in Fresno, who has developed a computerized mammal hair database that can be used by practitioners around the world to analyze hair and trafficking cases of the world's most endangered animals. This internet-based database will ultimately hold more than 2,000 mammal species and has already become well-known in the professional forensic world, including the prestigious National Institute of Justice and the Federal Bureau of Investigation, or FBI. In fact, Gonzalez received the 2010 Wildlife Forensic Science Award from the Society for Wildlife Forensic Sciences for outstanding thesis work that has been recognized by the FBI. Under the direction of his faculty mentor, Dr. Kevin Miller, who is an assistant professor of chemistry and criminology at Fresno State and director of the Forensic Science Master's Program, Gonzalez began creating and compiling the database from hair specimens found in the collection of Fresno State's biology department. This work quickly spread to include 8 different body regions of each animal and is being conducted in collaboration with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Forensics Laboratory in Ashland, Oregon. His pilot work was presented in the summer of 2009 at the Trace Evidence Symposium in Florida, which was co-sponsored by the National Institute of Justice and the FBI. This symposium is an international forum for forensic professionals to learn from each other and present new ways to analyze forensic trace evidence recovered from crime scenes. He also presented it at the Society of Wildlife Forensic Scientists inaugural meeting in April 2010, where I met him. Professionals agree that Gonzalez's computerized online mammal hair database will provide a valuable digital resource for researchers and forensic investigators for both wildlife trafficking cases, to identify key structural features of the hairs they are likely to encounter, and in human cases as a reference for non-human hairs that may need to be identified from the scenes of violent crimes. Gonzalez is enrolled in the Professional Science Master's Degree Program in the Chemistry Department of the College of Science and Mathematics and is the program's first Hispanic student. When I spoke to Michael, I asked him how he first got interested in forensics.
During my undergraduate days, I did my undergraduate at University of California, Riverside, and I was pre-med pretty much the entire time, and I had really never looked outside the realm of becoming a doctor. That was kind of always my mindset, and that's always what I wanted to do. And when I graduated, I got a degree in medical biology. I just kind of stopped and I said, you know, I don't think med school's for me right now. I want to do something else. And I decided that I was going to go for my master's. I had no idea in what, and I started looking around. I wanted to get into a field that was, I mean, relatively new and had some things going on as far as research and stuff like that. And I saw forensics, and I saw a program up at Fresno State. It was a brand new program.
And so, what is the name of the program that you're in?
I'm in the Professional Science Master's Program in Forensic Science.
And that's mostly geared toward human forensics, is that right?
It is, yeah.
Now,
since
this is the wildlife radio show, you know, how did you move into wildlife forensics?
You know, like you mentioned, it was our lab and pretty much all labs in our program are specifically geared toward the human aspect of forensics, and I've kind of broken the mold with going away from that and going into the wildlife aspect, I guess. And this project actually started as a class project. I actually joined the program in fall of 2008, and we had an introductory forensic science program to kind of get our feet wet, and we had a lab component to that class. And this was kind of an idea between the class and Professor Miller, how to fill our lab time.
And that's Professor Kevin Miller.
Yes, Professor Kevin Miller. And we had a pretty good sized collection of, I would say, California mammals in our biology department. And so we decided to utilize that to start with. And we started collecting hair from the dorsal region of the specimens that we had. And we decided to take some pictures. And it's just kind of snowballed from there. And I mean, if you looked back from where it's come and where it is now, you wouldn't recognize it. But I mean, that's how it all started.
And then within human forensic science, how does animal hair enter in? I guess I was wondering if, you know, at crime scene, say a murder of a person, if animal hair, you know, sometimes shows up and can link people to a particular crime scene. Are there cases of human forensic science that deal also with animal hair?
Yes, and actually that has happened, as you mentioned, the murder case that have I believe it was dog hair that helped corroborate hair evidence found at the crime scene with the murder suspect. But as a society, we've kind of had a lot of involvement as far as having domestic breeds, dogs, cats, sheep, goats. I mean, we pretty much live with them and are very much involved in with them. And since hair is, it's shed readily by the human body and all animals. So, I mean, it is maybe not commonplace at crime scenes, but definitely found around. And I mean, if there is a dog or cat or domestic animal living in the house where the crime took place, I mean, there's definitely going to be some hair or some kind of remnants of that animal living there, which can be used to corroborate certain pieces of evidence, to place suspects at the scene of the crime, and do other things like that.
Are mammals the only ones with hair?
That's something that makes them mammals, yeah, the presence of hair.
And what kind of different hairs do mammals have? I guess I was wondering if you could take me on a little tour of the structure of hair and sort of their qualities. Who knew that there were so many different kinds of hair within one animal? You know, guard hair and secondary hair. So I'd love for you to take listeners through, you know, what kinds of hairs do mammals have?
Well, mammals definitely have a lot of hair, and we call these different types of hair grades of hair that we see on different animals, especially the common fur bearers that we would see in a wildlife forensic context.
So what are those kinds?
They have several different kinds, usually split into two categories, the underhair and the overhairs.
So what do the underhairs do?
The underhair mainly functions to kind of insulate the animal, provide warmth. It's much more, how do I want to say it? It has an undulating appearance, I guess. And it usually clumps together, and it's very close to the mammal's skin.
What about the guard hairs? What do they do?
Now, the guard hairs, which is what we're more interested in as far as seeing identifying characteristics, are usually longer, they're coarser, and they function more in protection. And they actually, in reflecting sunlight and stuff like that.
Is all guard hair the same, or are there different types of guard hair within an animal?
There are different grades of guard hair as well. So there, like you said, there are primary and secondary guard hairs. And our database is going to include both of these, because they both contain characteristics that a forensic examiner can look at and can get some sort of idea the animal that they're looking at.
Do I have guard hairs?
Yeah.
I do?
You do have guard hairs, yeah.
Where can I see my guard hairs?
so head hairs for humans, mainly primary guard hairs. You won't see much under fur on humans because we've kind of evolved past the point of needing that full body coverage of hair.
But my head, the hair on my head is a mm-hmm. is like guard hair.
Yeah.
Huh. And do I have secondary and primary on my head?
You know, I'm not sure. I'm not sure of that question. If humans have secondary and primaries, I mean, I'm sure they have hairs that are shorter than others. I'm not sure if they would all be primary or secondary, though.
So, like with my dog sheds all the time. Is she shedding? Is she shedding her guard hairs or her under fur or both?
Yeah, she'd be shedding both. I believe mammals primarily shed guard hairs more than any other, though.
There's a lot of variation in hair.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, within one animal or within one hair, it can vary along the same hair shaft. So I'd like to talk about the variation, but first have you take me through sort of the structure of the hair. So for me, it's just like a piece of hair.
Mm-hmm.
But for you, it's not.
Yeah.
So like going from, say, the root out to the end, or the split end, as it might be. what are the parts of the hair?
So your hair is going to differentiate into three morphological regions that we're going to want to look at in a forensic context. The outer layer is called the cuticle, and this is composed of hair. First off, is primarily composed of keratin, about 95%. And
So 95% of my hair is keratin, which is like the same thing that's in my fingernails,
mm-hmm.
and the same stuff that's in rhino horn.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so the outer layer you said was called the cuticle?
Yeah, the outer layer is called the cuticle, and it functions to protect the hair, obviously, as the outer layer. And these cells kind of grow over each other, kind of like shingles on a roof. And the way these cells grow over each other form a certain pattern. And these patterns can be indicative of certain orders, certain families, and could even be used to get down to the genus level. Well, some think that you can get down to the genus level. That's kind of up for debate how useful the cuticle scale patterns are. But so,
okay, so this,
I don't know how sure I want to be on on the identification that can be made there, but...
So if you look under a microscope, you would be able to see a pattern that looks like shingles, and that pattern, what you just called scale patterns, would differ from,
mm-hmm.
From animal grouping. So like, cows might have different scale patterns than humans or horses or rhinos or something.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But, it's not always... like that. They don't always have different scale patterns, and you can't always recognize that if you look at this certain scale pattern, like, oh yeah, this is definitely such and such. You definitely have to dig further. Like, you should never make an identification based solely on just looking at a cuticle scale.
So what would you do?
You want to kind of get the hair in its entirety, not only microscopic characteristics, but macroscopic as well.
What do you mean by macroscopic?
Kind of looking at the hair just like with your naked eye. And also if you do get any kind of information with that hair, you want to take that into account as well and kind of make a full evaluation of all the information that you're given.
When you talk about macroscopic, that's just basically looking at it without a microscope. And microscopic is looking at it with a microscope.
Mm-hmm.
So what kinds of things would you make sure to take note of when you're looking macroscopically?
Well, I mean, you look at a lot of things. You look at color. You look at the shape of the hair, if it's flat, if it's more round. You look at the length of the hair, because that can tell you if it's from a bigger animal versus a smaller animal. You just look at the hair in its entirety. If it comes with a clump of hair or on a pelt, then you look at that section of pelt that you were given. If you see any changes with the pelt, if you see any different grades of hair on the pelt, you want to include all of that in your investigation.
To get back to the idea of the microscopic, we were just talking about the parts of a hair, and you had started with the outer layer being the cuticle and that there was a scale pattern. What else is involved in a hair?
Another layer that's pretty much the main layer, or not the main layer, but The main component of the hair is called the cortex of the hair.
And what is the cortex? Is that like what I would think of as the shaft or the inside of it?
It's on the inside. It's not the center of the hair.
What's in the center of the hair? What's that called?
Going down the shaft is something called the medulla. It's going down the very center of the hair.
And is that medulla, that center part, always present in hair for all kinds of mammals?
Again, getting back to the idea of variability, the medulla isn't always present. I mean, and it varies widely across the mammal class.
And that variability applies to everything you're talking about, is that right?
Everything that I'm saying, I mean, might have an exception or there might be differences that one might see.
Just to make it very difficult and interesting.
Yeah, I mean, in deers, for example, the medulla takes up the entire hair shaft and there's no cortex at all. Huh. And in certain mammals, it's going to be unmedullated. There's going to be no medulla whatsoever, and it's just going to be all cortex. Explaining those two extremes kind of illustrates the variability that you're going to see. I mean, you're going to see all cortex. I mean, you're going to see all medulla. You're going to see no medulla and everything in between. So, I mean, it makes it quite difficult to make identification. So you kind of appreciate the knowledge that these mammalogists and morphologists have to kind of get involved in this kind of thing and actually make designations based on what they see. I mean, it blows me away. I haven't gotten involved in it in a professional sense, but yeah, every time I think about it, it overwhelms me.
So it's almost like a tree, sort of, with the inside of the tree being the medulla and outside of that being the cortex, and sometimes you would have one or the other.
You know how it was explained to me? It was the anatomy of a hair, I guess, was compared to a number 2 pencil.
Okay.
So the yellow paint on the outside would be the cuticle.
Okay.
The wood inside that would be the cortex, and the lead in the very center would be your medulla.
Oh, that's a good mental picture. And so within the cortex, which is like the wood on the inside, what does that look like? Does that have those type of scales too, or?
It doesn't, and it's the cortex is fairly forensically indistinct, I guess I could say. It does contain some things that are important that we do look at. It does contain the pigment granules that we want to look at, and pigment aggregation and the way the pigment comes together is pretty important to note as far as your analysis goes. And that's kind of the main thing that we look at in the cortex. As far as that goes, the cortex really doesn't give us a lot. I mean, the only other thing it gives us is our medullary index, which is the comparison of the diameter of the medulla to the diameter of the shaft as a whole.
Okay, so like a ratio between
right.
How much cortex and how much medulla you've got in there.
Yes.
Or how much wood and how much lead.
Exactly.
So then the medulla, or the lead part, what's in there that you would look at?
So the medulla, as I was explaining earlier, definitely varies widely. And you're going to see, a whole bunch of configurations that you might see across the mammal class. I mean, you can definitely see cellular structure, and you can describe this cellular structure, how the cells arrange themselves in the center of the hair is pretty important to note, and it gives you a basis for comparison when you do make that make your comparison to the reference standard.
When you look at them, what do you when you think of how the cells are arranging themselves, and so when you look at this pattern or this picture, I assume it looks like sort of like an abstract picture that my 8-year-old did. No. And you know, and what sorts of things does it remind you of? Like clouds or leaves or overlapping shells, or what's it look like?
Well, that would depend on what you're looking at.
That's a great answer. That's a great answer.
Yeah.
So, or just give me a couple examples.
I mean, there are definitely certain families that you would look at under a microscope, and you would have no doubt that's what you're looking at. The order Lagomorpha, for example, the rabbits. They have a very distinct hair structure. It's called multiserial ladder as far as the medulla structure goes. And that reminds you a lot of corn on the cob, I would say. reminds me of corn on the cob. That's what it looks like. It looks like little corn kernels arranged in rows and going down the hair shaft. And, I mean, something like Cervidae, the deer family. How would I describe that? You know, I'm not really sure how to describe that, but you would definitely know a deer when you saw one.
Hmm.
They kind of have diamond-shaped sort of petals, I want to say. But it takes up, like I said before, it takes up the medulla takes up the entirety of the hair shaft.
So it's really a combination of all of these things that you look at. You know, if this much medulla plus this type of pattern plus this, you know.
Right. Yeah. So, everything kind of comes into play when you're trying to make identification. You never base your identification solely on just one aspect. Like if you took, I don't know, shaft diameter, for example, and you say, oh, these two shaft diameters match. I mean, that wouldn't be very, very strong. You know what I mean? That you would want to include everything that you can see into your evaluation in order to make your case and make your case that much stronger.
So tell me more about the big picture of, you know, of this mammal hair database. You know, what gave you the idea to create this?
It was initially Dr. Kevin Miller's idea to kind of fill our lab time. And we didn't really know how it would be used or how it could be kind of implemented in the field. We were just kind of putting in our lab hours, you know.
And lo and behold, it's really useful, and it's gotten recognition from the FBI and the Fish and Wildlife Service, National Wildlife Forensic Lab. So it's really very, very cool.
Yeah.
You know, can you describe what it is and what kind of information it has?
We're creating a mammal hair atlas.
And what mammals are included?
We've decided to include animals that are, well, we decided to focus on mammals of North America first and foremost. But we also decided to include a lot of the common fur bearers that might be foreign, a lot of the African big game animals that are commonly seen in wildlife forensic casework. I want to say that this database is special because it's the first one that's forensically driven.
So what you're talking about here is the need to solve wildlife trafficking cases. And that's where rare and protected species are being illegally collected or poached and then bought and sold. And while sometimes these animals are alive and sold as pets and easy to identify, frequently these animals have been processed into some type of product, like a fur coat or a piece of jewelry. And what that means is that in order to even establish that a crime was committed, an agent must first be able to say with certainty that a species is, or that a product is from a certain type of species. Because once you can prove what species it is, you can prove that that species is protected by law, and then consequently prove that there was a crime. And that's where the forensic scientist comes in. Say when a striped pelt or a spotted fur coat is confiscated, the forensic scientist has to identify what species that fur or pelt contains. And your mammal hair atlas can help do that. So that's what you mean when you say it's forensically driven, right?
It's specifically designed to cater to the needs of the forensic morphologist, and because they have to make those identifications, we wanted to make a resource that was specifically for them.
So what are the things that make it more oriented toward a forensic scientist? It sounds like just number one, the species that are included.
Right. So number one, the species coverage that we decided to include.
So what were some of them?
Like I said, the African big game animals, the common fur bearers.
What are some of the common fur bearers that you're talking about?
That would be like the mink, the beaver, the fox, like things you would see like in fur coats or something like that.
And so other types of animals that are included, things in international trade?
Yeah, so things that would be seen in international trade. We have about 80 endangered species as well, animals that are protected by certain wildlife law, by CITES, the international trade agreement. So we do have a lot of those animals as well.
Well, how did you go about building this atlas?
We started with the collection that we had at CSU, at California State University, Fresno. And we had about 250 species in our biology department. And it was, like I said, mainly from the western coast of the United States, Oregon, Washington, California area.
How about some of those exotic species that you were talking about?
To get our more exotic animals and to kind of fill in the gaps and get the animals that are really forensically relevant, we actually went up to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife National Forensic Laboratory in Ashland, Oregon, which has quite a good hair collection, I would say, and they were nice enough to let me collect. And I actually worked very closely with Bonnie Yates, the morphologist up there, and we actually made a list that she thought would best suit the needs of the wildlife forensic community, and we kind of went from there, and it's been going ever since.
So just to clarify, that's the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service National Wildlife Forensic Laboratory. And it's the only dedicated wildlife crime lab in the world. There are other labs that work on wildlife forensics, but this is the only dedicated wildlife crime lab in the world. Now going back to the issue of hair and how you collected samples for this atlas.
So it's not as if you were collecting hair from a hopping kangaroo.
No. we mainly deal in with animal skins. We don't do live collection.
Hold it right there. Just wait 1 minute. What's your favorite animal that you've included? Or what's your favorite kind of hair?
Ooh.
Or is there any hair that stands out in particular to you?
You know, I actually really like bat hair. But I mean, bat hair is really
Why?
Hard. Because it's unique.
What makes it unique?
The shape of the hair, how the pigment aggregates. It's just it looks like no other, I guess I would say.
Because I did notice that when we were out at the lab together last April, and you saw that you could get hair from a bat from the lab, and you were very excited about getting hair from the bat cave.
I jumped on that opportunity.
So, and do all bats, if you're a bat, do you have sort of similar shapes, no matter what species, and similar characteristics if you're a bat?
Yeah, you definitely have similar characteristics, which makes it difficult to kind of narrow down what bat you're looking at. I mean, it's very difficult to get beyond family with a bat identification, since the hair is so similar across those family and different genera. But I mean, as a whole, it's unique to any other that you would see in the mammal class.
And has there been any species that you're just dying to get, but you can't find for your database?
You know, I think the forensic lab up in Oregon did a very good job, and our coverage in the database now has kind of, yeah, I don't really feel a need to go collect anymore. I think we have a very good coverage. I mean, I would not say no to more samples. Of course, I'll probably always be adding to this database for the rest of my life. But for now, I think the species that we've collected kind of go above and beyond what has been done before, and really adds to what they can do with hair identifications.
How large is the database? How many hairs are in? You know, have you examined basically?
Wow, that's a good question. I have to do some math real quick. Let's see, we have about 260 species, and we do 2 grades of hair from each species from 3 areas on the body. It's about 1,500 hairs.
1,500 separate hairs that you've looked at.
Yeah, and that's just, those are just the ones that we chose to be, or that we saw to be the most representative. That's not necessarily all the ones we've plated.
And by plated, you mean look at, prepare, put on a microscope slide.
We try to plate about 3 to 5 hairs per microscope slide. So that's about 1,560 slides that we prepare. But then multiply that by 3 to 5, and that's kind of how many we've plated. And then and then we take 3 images per hair on each hair. So it multiplies it again. So it's quite a lot. I mean,
that's a lot of work.
They'll have a lot to look through. They definitely, we don't short them on images for sure.
So how do you go about examining the hair? So you pluck it off a pelt or something, presumably.
Well, we usually cut it with a razor blade.
Okay.
And we cut a pretty small section. Probably the size of a pencil eraser.
Okay.
And we collect this and store it, label it, and all that stuff. And then later we pull that out when we're ready to plate it. And
by plating it, you mean putting it on a microscope slide?
Right. Right. So.
And that's no easy task because you're dealing with one little hair.
Yeah. You know, sometimes for the smaller animals, the shrews and the moles and the rodents, it gets pretty difficult. Because I mean, that's actually, some of those hairs are actually hard to see. Just see, period. it gets kind of taxing when you get to the smaller. When you get to the smaller animals, definitely.
How do you keep your patience? Do you play some music? Or
you know, I definitely play some relaxing music. I never do one thing for a long period of time. Since this project is so large, I mean, I'm involved in finding the samples, collecting the samples, properly labeling and storing the samples, plating the samples, analyzing the samples, and then also creating the user interface, the website that we're designing. So, I mean, it definitely has a whole bunch of different things that I could be doing. So if I ever do get tired of one thing, then I just, like, move on to another facet of the project, like website design. I'll probably never be done with the website, so I could always kind of jump to that if I get bored with, you know, plating hair or looking at hair under the microscope or something like that.
And what's your favorite part of the whole thing?
You know, it's definitely not plating for sure. So I would say it's a close race between actually getting looking at hair under the microscope and being able to surf those hairs, and creating the website, how the public is going to view kind of what I've done and how I've organized this database.
So how have you organized the database? It looks very easy to use because it's got a lot of good information about the species as well.
Right. We definitely tried to include as much information as possible, or as much information that one would need that if they wanted to make an identification. So, I mean, we've included different references that they can use. We've included geographic distribution of the species that they want to look at. We've included different areas on the body, like I said, different grades of hair. And it's currently not searchable, but that's definitely something that we do want to get into coming up in the future here very shortly. We do want to make it a kind of a query-driven database where you can kind of type in your characteristic and it might give you a number of hits. Because right now, I mean, you would have to have a certain amount of taxonomic background, I would say, in order to get the full utility of the database. Because it does search by initially a phylogenetic tree, and then you have to know the species that you're looking for. You have to know the, you know.
You'd have to know, oh, maybe I have a rabbit hair, and you go into that family and sort of dig down deep to start looking that way.
Right.
And then say, no, I was wrong. Let me try deer. What has been the strangest reaction you've gotten when you've told somebody what you work on?
You know, I don't really have a lot of strange reactions. I mean, I think I'm able to explain it well enough where people are like, oh, I see. That's that seems cool. So I don't know if they're just placating me or they think I'm weird and they just don't let me know, or I'm just in denial and I can't see it.
So now when you walk around, do you like check out every animal's hair?
You know, I have been guilty. I mean, I actually recently took a road trip to Virginia, and we would see you know, roadkill on the side of the road, and I'd be like, "What animal was it?" And my sister was like, "Oh my God, you're such a weirdo," and she. I haven't stopped and collected yet. I just want to put that out there.
Well, a lot of people,
because of the book I wrote on wildlife forensics called Animal Investigators: How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species.
Yeah, a lot of friends will be like, "Oh, I found this great moose tooth," or you know, whatever. And so people are constantly giving me animal parts. Plus, I'm finding it. So. What's been the funniest experience you've had doing this database?
The funniest, huh? Oh, these are toughies.
See, I was picturing you, you know, going to a sleeping bear in a den, and then you want to just go get one hair. And no, I'm just kidding.
I mean, I guess it's funny to other people. It wasn't very funny to me at the time, but I mean, we have included a domestic section for this database as well. And I'm not leading up that section of the project, but I do help in hair collection. So we have to go to, you know, horses, sheep, cows, and a bunch of different dogs. So I love dogs. I love cats and stuff like that. When they get really, really large, like horses and cows, you know, like I'm a little nervous around them. I haven't really had a lot of experience with horses and the girl that's actually heading up the domestic section, her name is Elsbeth Murata. She's a pre-vet major at Fresno State. She's been around these really huge animals for, you know, her entire life. So she has no problem with it. And she's like, "Don't be nervous." And I'm just like, you know, I'm a bigger guy, but a 2,000-pound animal always is going to scare me, and I'm just like, okay, grab the hair and let's go. Let's get out of here. So live collection, probably not in my future, but I could definitely be in a lab looking at hair under a microscope. That's more my speed.
So I picture you the other way, you know, the Indiana Jones of hair collection.
Yeah, see, so that's what people say, and that's not that way.
And so is it difficult to notice the differences between, you know, families or genuses? Because to me, when you have a hair, I don't know that I would be able to pick out all these subtle differences. Or do you just, you know, develop an eye? How has that been for you?
I mean, it definitely takes practice, and it takes an eye, and it takes time, really getting experience using the microscope, and really kind of, I mean, just kind of as practice, I just put a random hair under the microscope and just kind of go back and forth on the hair and see how the hair varies from root to tip, and how the medulla will change, how the cortex will change, how pigment aggregation changes along the shaft and stuff like that. So I mean, it definitely takes practice. It definitely takes a discerning eye. But you always want to make an identification based on a comparison to a reference standard. So you want a verified sample that comes from the animal that you think it is. Like say you think you have some beaver hair. You would want to go get a beaver, like a beaver pelt from an actual collection, pull some hair, and actually make a side-by-side comparison on a comparison microscope. And this really helps in the sense that you don't really have to pick out certain characteristics and be like, oh, okay, that's beaver for sure. You compare like to like, and you compare this region on the reference standard that you know what it is. You know it's a beaver, and you compare that to your unknown, and you try to make a match that way.
So you just talked about something that's really, really important in forensics about the reference specimens. So where do you get the reference specimens, or it just depends who has that thing that you're wanting to look at?
Yeah, I mean, it just depends who has it in their collection. I mean, the Fish and Wildlife National Forensic Laboratory is the only full-service wildlife forensic laboratory in the world. So, I mean, they have quite a collection of specimens, museum decommissions, and trophy mounts, stuff like that. Pretty much anything that you can think of that could be used for identification based on morphology.
I guess I wanted to close... No, that's great. I'm really glad you got into the reference specimens, because that's so key.
Yeah.
And people.
Definitely important. Yeah. this database was not meant to be a replacement for actual microscopical comparison. It definitely wasn't. It was this database has been designed as kind of an aid to help that. It's been designed as a launching point for further investigation. You should never base your identification solely on what you see in my database. That would be not a good thing.
But it would give you a place to start. So if I had... If I wanted to go check out some fur that I find in my yard and want to know what kind of animal had been killed or something... Naturally, I might be able to look at it under the microscope and at least give me a place to start. And it would probably be a rabbit because we have thousands of them. But if someone wanted to do that, you had described about how you would practice looking at a random hair under a microscope. And could kids who are interested in forensics, is that a fun thing for folks to do? And then maybe try and figure out what kind of... further looking at?
You know, I think so.
I do too, but...
But a lot... I don't know. A lot of the forensic community is really interested in DNA, and that's kind of like the... That's kind of the big thing right now, but I think hair is immensely interesting, and I just think the variation that you would see, it's kind of like... I don't know. It's kind of like solving a puzzle, I guess.
That's a good way to put it. And so then it would vary. It would vary from specific animal to animal, from species to species, and within the animal, it might vary from, like on the neck. You had said from. You had said that you look at different regions on the animal. So, what are the regions that you look at?
We look at three areas on each animal. We look at dorsal guard hairs, so right between the shoulder blades. We look at the ventral portion of the animal, and we look at the tip of the tail.
So where is the ventral?
The ventral is the belly. So we went right in the middle between the hind and forelimbs is where we collected our ventral samples from.
Okay. And then the tip of the tail?
Right. And we included these 'cause from experience that those are the areas that are the most morphologically diverse as far as hair is concerned, I guess I should say. We do collect seven areas on the body, and that includes top of foot, back of thigh, forehead, and vibrisse, which is the whiskers of the animal. So we do collect all of those. We just at minimum we do the three areas that I described before. But if we do see some sort of variation, like if a certain mammal has different coloring in a specific part of their body, we would definitely collect that and upload pictures of that area as well.
So within one type of animal, hair might vary from whether it's taken on the forehead or on the belly or on the tail.
Mm-hmm.
Was that right?
Yeah.
And then it also, you had said it would vary even within the same strand of hair, looking from root to tip.
Oh, yeah.
Is that right?
Definitely.
And then all of this analysis clearly requires a keen eye and plenty of patience.
Oh, yeah.
So how did you get those qualities?
You know, I don't know where I got the eye from, but I've always had the patience. That's always been there. And I think because I had the patience, it kind of helped me to just kind of sit down and say, like, you know what, I have to learn this. I mean, this is something that needs to be learned. And I mean, Bonnie Yates and Cookie Sims have kind of taken me under their wing and kind of really showed me the ropes as far as making identification based on hair, which has really been a blessing to me. I mean, when I started this project, I really had no idea what I was getting into and how it would be used and how properly to even do a hair examination. And they've really been instrumental in making this database a success.
And when will the database be available to the public? Or are parts of it available now?
I would like it to be available to the public probably in January.
So in January 2011?
Yes.
So if people want to, you know, check it out at that point, they should just Google Mammal Hair Atlas or something like that?
They might do better Googling Hairbase. I think that would work better. I think that's the name that we're going forward with.
Hairbase.
Yep.
Okay. So they should be able to find it at that point.
Right.
And then do you think that, you know, when you graduate, will you be going into human forensics or back to medicine, or will you stick with wildlife forensics?
You know, that's a real tough question. I don't know the answer to that one right now. I know I want to continue my education, so I do want to continue on and get my PhD. Whether that's in forensics, I don't really know yet. To answer your question, I have no idea what I want to do.
And I guess I'll close with, how have you found that human and wildlife forensics are similar or different?
I think they're very different, actually. I mean, even the presence of a morphology section at the Fish and Wildlife Lab is kind of outside the ordinary. That's kind of unheard of in the human forensic realm. And I think that's part of the reason I kind of wanted to get involved in this project, because it did allow me to kind of take my training in anatomy and biology and kind of apply it to two different types of wildlife and how it's different. And I think because in human forensics, I mean, you deal mainly with obviously humans, and in wildlife forensics, I mean, it's just, I mean, the diversity of your evidence is just insane. I mean, you pretty much have things coming in from everywhere, and it's anything on an animal that can be, pretty much. And they have to, like, the morphologists there have to kind of take these things that they recognize, these certain characteristics, and make identifications based on those, which is, I mean, I think it makes it very, very different, I guess I would say. I just think that so much more goes into it, since they deal with such a wide variety of evidence, and they just have to know so much.
Well, I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with me.
Oh, no problem. I had fun.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation about wildlife forensics and mammal hair with Michael Gonzalez, a forensic science master's student at California State University in Fresno. Now, let me play you today's creature call once again and see if you've guessed it correctly. This week's creature call comes from a flying mammal that eats many kinds of night-flying insects, like mosquitoes, moths, beetles, and wasps, which they catch during their flight. Have you guessed it yet? It's a big brown bat. The big brown bat is about 4 to 5 inches long and has a 12-inch wingspan. Its fur is moderately long and shiny brown. The wing membranes, ears, feet, and face are dark brown to a blackish in color. Big brown bats are nocturnal. They roost during the day in hollow trees or rock crevices or old buildings, eaves, window shutters, and the like. Then they fly through the dark skies using echolocation, which means that they produce these ultrasonic sounds through their nose or mouth. These bats also make audible sounds during flight, with its voice like a click or the sound of escaping steam. Listen to the sounds of a big brown bat.
Archived episodes of The Wildlife are available on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com.
The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.